part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, shall we just get started? Shall we begin our chat, our little interview?
Yeah, let's do it.
Episode 400, Philip Myra. This is it. The pressure's on. Oof. Pressure's on to be entertaining. Episode 400. Let us just say that this is episode 400 of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn, feeling 400 years old because I've done 400 episodes. My special guest, I've already said his name a little bit, Philip Myra, right? I got the last name. Did I mess it up?
No, you got it right.
I got it right. I mean, you've been on the podcast enough. I should know your last name enough. But what is this? Is this like third or fourth time?
I think this is, this is third time.
Oh, wow. There you go. You're like, you're part of the three-time club. There you go. Well, let's just say right off the bat, like what you're here for. I mean, you have another, it's an anthology. It's called Purple Eyes. It's on Kickstarter. But this is a little bit different from you, right? Because, I mean, it's still an anthology book. It's like different stories, correct? But it's based under one theme and it's not you. You usually like write all your stuff, like all the stuff in your anthologies, right? But this is different writers that you've invited, different creators, correct?
Yeah, it's a slight divergent and a large enhancement from what I'm usually do. So
enhancement.
Well, I mean, I'll explain. Like my usual, like how you mentioned, Christian, like my usual anthology series is called Crackle. And
yeah.
All the stories within those are written by myself. And I've, been so lucky to collaborate with illustrators from all over the world to bring those stories to life. And so after three volumes of Crackle, I was looking to do a larger scale anthology series where I'm most of my duties predominantly was as editor instead of as the writer. Mm-hmm. So that's what this is. So this is Purple Eyes, and it's an expansion upon a short story that Sean Dicker and Justin Birch and I, the three of us, created. And that short story has a clear-cut beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules of that world kept lingering in my mind, and they were so unique. And the premise is that 73 minutes before you die, your eyes turn a vibrant purple, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's
73 minutes. For some reason, I thought it was 73 hours.
No, it's 73 minutes because it's just so hyper-limiting. There's nothing you can do, but there's, people try to structure their lives in ways to make those, make their lives have stronger meaning, or to try to figure out ways how, like almost like a bucket list, we call it a purple list of, things you want to accomplish within those 73 minutes. But it's, with anything, it's, you can have this pre-planned, but you're going to be in horrible panic mode. You know for certain that you're going to die within 73 minutes. And we put all these like little caveats that it's 100% accurate. There's no medical treatments. There's nothing that you can do or choose or other people can assist to alleviate this purple eyes. There's no one. I mean, this was similar. I always call it similar to The Leftovers, where it's our world, and then this extra layer, this event happened. Mm-hmm. So the stories within this anthology occur about 5 to 10 years after the first instance of purple eyes. So like society's kind of shifted toward this being a normal part of all everyday society, all over the world, because we have so many international artists and creators on this book. So everyone's setting their stories within their local environment, like the place they grew up. So it's a good flavor of just ideas and just perspectives. Yeah, I know we're kind of bouncing around a bit, but
no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a chat is. I mean, I think you've laid it out really well. I mean, let me think about all the questions that I have, because I mean, I do have questions. So was your first story, was this part of the Crackle anthology? I can't remember. Was it in one of those books?
Yeah, it was in the most recent. So this was in Crackle Volume 3. It was the last story within that anthology.
Okay.
It was the story that was, it just ended up being the story that was most, it was the last to be completed script-wise and last to be completed art-wise. So it was the one that did kind of linger, you know, closer to, I was like, there's something here. And I didn't have, I mean, at that point, I didn't have my next jumping off point. Like, should I start working more on a Crackle Volume 4? You get that ball rolling? Because I usually try to get a Crackle out every 12 to 16 months or so.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I think I'm going to take this risk. I'm going to do, you know, do a where I have the editor hat and I invite. I had open submissions for this project. There was 185 open submissions.
Wow. Of
just so much talent, so much artistic talent, so much storytelling talent, and just ideas. And it was very, very hard to reject any of them. It was just, and there's such a wide variety of genres. And like it was very limiting. I put a limiting on the limitations on what I was looking for. I just said, as long as you tell me the genre and the creative team, because I asked just for creative teams prior, you know, that I wasn't doing like the matchmaking part of like editing. I was asking for full creative teams up front, and just give me your rough estimate of page count so I can kind of figure out, you know, budget wise. And then you tell me your feel of genre, so I can get a good feel, as well as just the pitch. So I kind of left it as open ended as I thought possible. And then I let everyone know, like, listen, like, this is a paid anthology. Once the Kickstarter is funded, then I'll pay all the creatives. Yeah. Because that was another key thing, is I was looking around. When I was doing my initial research for, like, is this a feasible next step? Like, I knew it was a big risk, but I was in pre-planning mode. So I was looking at other anthologies that either recently wrapped up or around that time currently had pitch submissions open. Mm-hmm. And I was looking, and there were just some really devastatingly, I keep saying predatory page rates. There were anthologies. I'm not going to name names, but I mean, if any creators listening to this, like, see $50 for a page rate for anthology, that's horrendous. Like,
yeah,
that's so many.
Is like, that even full, like, illustration colored and like everything?
Yeah. Yeah. It's everything, even including writing. So,
oh, wow.
But like, it's just like a flat $50 per page. And like, that's
split up between all creators?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's kind of rough.
I mean, I saw one of them, and then there was another one that I think was roughly around there, but it was in euro, so I'm not sure what the conversion rate is. But it's
still, that's what Google's for, Philip.
Yeah. It still was like not, you know, it needs to at least be in three digits, like, for a page rate.
Well, I mean, at least if you're talking about split up between like three or four creators, for sure. Yeah. I mean, something like that. But no, let me just stop you for a second and ask, like, how did you sort of like put out the call? How do you put out, for anyone who's interested in like doing an anthology, like, how did you set up your announcement and be like, hey, I'm looking for talent, like, just Twitter, Facebook, whatever, Instagram? Like, did you just say, I'm thinking about doing a book, or is there a specific place, or did you just email people? Like, how did it work?
Yeah. To get the word out, for me, I kept the submission open for 6 weeks, and I thought that was a good enough time to get the word out, but also to get people to prep. And for me, I just did Twitter, because that's my main social media platform.
Yeah.
So I had my fan bases. I contacted, at least on Twitter, Creator Advisor, which is a fantastic resource overall for comic book creators.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I think Stephanie Cook, she curates that. But I've had a tangential connection with them because whenever I was finding artists for the Crackle books, yeah. Same thing. Like I would create stories for Crackle is like I personally as the writer finish the script and then I seek out the artists that I think would best, that would best visually and storytelling elements be good for the story. But for that, I always do open submissions for that as well. So I would, in the past, I've contacted Creative Advisor and be like, hey, can you just boost this, you know, like retweet this tweet where it has a link to the script and, you know, it's a paid, I'm paying the artists for their work and their skills. And through that, I've had two collaborators that I found through there that are in Crackle Volume 3. So they have a very good network, and people that follow that are artists that are looking for paid opportunities and that are highly skilled. So I've reached out to them, and they shout out in the megaphone a couple times. They were super helpful. I've had friends. My friends reached out to like the parts of the internet that I'm not like the communities that I'm not part of, like sure. My friend,
like the dark web or whatever.
No, my friend does like an anthology. I think I forget what the name of it is, but he also does admin. That's what it is. Admin for a Facebook group that does like indie, and I can't remember if it's indie anthology submission type of things or like, but like him and like a bunch of my friends just got the word out, but then things just keep spreading. There was only two out of the 33 creators in this book. Sean Dicker and Justin Birch are returning. So those are two. But like only two other of my friends are in the book too. So everyone else came from friends of friends or just they heard about it somewhere. And those were the people that just got in the book. Out of the 185 pitches, there are so many creators that I had no idea about the work. So at least for me, how I, kind of split up, trying to figure out all these pitches is I had like a huge spreadsheet, and then I had like yes, no's, and maybes. Mm-hmm. And so I took the time and like looked at the pitch and looked at everyone's portfolios of all skill sets, because that was part of the submission process is to leave, if you have multiple people, leave their social, portfolio link. So I was looking at every single person's portfolio.
Yeah.
And like I said, there was just so many talented creators I had no idea about. Like I didn't know that A, they existed, or B, I was unfamiliar with their work in general.
Yeah.
It was so painful to say no. Like even the ones that were in the no's, like a good chunk of them were no, because their idea was similar to another one, but executed better.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just heartbreaking. We can talk about this later, but like, I want to do a volume two. Like as soon as this is done and everyone has their copies, the idea is to start getting the wheels in motion in early 2023 to do a volume two, just because I know there's just so many ideas out there. But then as soon as this is super successful and there's something to point at as far as what, the feel, I guess you can say, of this Purple Eyes anthology, I just know there's just be that much more people interested in this next one. So there's just going to be even more ideas.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, that sounds really interesting. How challenging is it for you to sort of jump from, hey, I'm making my own stories, to getting submissions and then that stuff coming in, and then making your own judgment as to like what can go in, what can't go in, how much you have room for, like that sort of thing. How much stress does that bring down on you? Is it more stressful, less stressful?
I think it's lateral stress. Like, it's still stress.
Lateral, equally.
Yeah. Cause it's just another form. Like, I have the experience of running or curating and editing anthologies, even though if I was the key writer, it's still the open communication between multiple artists, deadlines. But like this time around, it's that on a grander scale, but it's still kind of the same to-do list. Like, it's contact, you know, do like a weekly email, you know, between the creative team, give them, you know, my big thing that I've learned throughout these years of doing anthologies, like, give your creative teams all their information as early as possible.
Yeah.
So especially like thinking like even the granular level, like, you know, we page turns are on the odd. So plan accordingly, you know, get your story beats based off of that. Here's all the file templates from the printer, so you can size accordingly and get, you know, everything to CMYK and the, you know, DPI.
Yeah.
Just like things of that nature, just so you have them in the forefront of your mind. And for me, at least this time around, I started, because before I would do this, you know, through like emails. So now it's like we have a shared Google folder. So all the resources are there. So here's a whole bunch of the template files. Here's a couple documents. And, you know, one of the things that is super unique, at least for this anthology, and I have not seen this before in indie comics, is we're trying to...
Oh, that's right. No, it's okay. We've had dogs on the podcast before.
Bowie, that's my dog, Bowie. He probably sees another dog out front.
He's got a great name.
Yeah. He has a blue eye and a brown eye like David Bowie.
Oh, nice. There you go.
So something that's unique about this anthology is that we are trying to connect the stories as much as possible. So it's not like the anthologies that I've gotten from Kickstarter and that I've seen in indie comics. They're either based off of like, I don't know, like a genre, or they're taking one to two public domain, you know, properties, you know, like I said, either combining them or just like talking about like a public domain property. This has a unique, almost like a story prompt idea of the 73 minutes left to live.
Yeah.
And so we're, like I said, we're trying to build this world, and so we're making it a world.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're meeting at least once a week on Zoom to just discuss like brainstorming ideas of our, like, how can we link your main character with, can it be like the sibling, or can it be the neighbor of this main character? Like, you know, where's yours located? Because one of the things we're kind of playing around with of like, all right, well, you know, if you put this unique design building in the background of your story, and then, you know, we can put that unique design building in someone else's story, and the reader will know that it's the both stories are happening at the same time, but like on the other side of the city, like type of things of that nature.
Sure. And no, just trying. That's cool. You're coordinating stuff.
Yeah. Like we, you know, I don't like to call them like Easter eggs, because like, it's not just little things that fill the world. It's ways to, you know, it's not like little tricks or anything. It's like, we're trying to make this feel as full as possible. And like, the idea is that, you know, you sit down one of the weekends and you read, you know, you go through all the stories. I mean, it's kind of a bulky anthology. It's going to be about 140 pages. But you read a good chunk of the stories, and you know, and then you go back maybe a couple weeks later and you reread the stories, and you see all these little threads that we put in there, and all, you know, either whether it be, you know, locations or we're trying to figure out better ways, not better, but like, we're trying to figure out effective ways to have characters that appear in multiple stories. And that's, you know, a challenge within itself, having unique identifying traits and you know, visual cues, because you have like a character that's drawn in multiple different art styles.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of a trick within itself, but just, you know, it's a happy challenge. You know what I mean? It's sure. Like something that all these artists are are stepping up and like, all right, like how can we do this? So it's that much more obvious.
Yeah. Okay. So this is like really interesting to me because, I mean, like you said, like a lot of anthologies, it's like, it's a horror anthology. It's a sci-fi anthology. It's you know, it's a swashbuckling anthology, you know, whatever, a gangster anthology,
yeah.
like kind of like the old RPG role-playing games. Like once they got popular in the 80s, there was like a genre, like every single type you could find, you know? But this is interesting because you've created sort of an idea of, and I mean, I don't know what to call it. It's not like a plague. It's not like a disease thing. It's a condition, right? That sort of happens. Yes. Is it just, well, let me get into that a little later before I sort of address this point. You've created sort of an idea, and like you said, like a prompt or something like that. And your collaborators or people that are coming in on this project are, they're building a story like off of that. And at the same time, you're trying to make it interconnected in a way. And I don't think that I've ever really, I mean, maybe it's been done before. It's just not springing to my mind, maybe because I'm a little tired this morning on a Sunday morning. But I feel like this doesn't seem like anything that I've really seen done before, at least in a while, where it's like, hey, we've come up with the idea for this anthology. This is the idea. Now go with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
of course you do, because you're creating it.
Yeah, but I think to kind of like piggyback off that is just that I didn't want to add another layer. So like, there's the purpleized layer, but I didn't want to add another layer of like, this is the set genre. So like, it's going to be action comedy type of thing. I wanted to have that free flowing openness for it, because that just yielded way better results. Like even the action ones, like they're, that's why I asked for the genre. Like the action ones are pretty actiony, and like looking at the art styles, those artists that are having those stories are great with action scenes. Like their storytelling and their movement, and the colors that they have with them, you know, it's going to be great. And the ones that are comedy, I can say straight up, there's three ones that are comedy. I laughed out loud when I read their pitches. I was like, these are funny. So that's why they're going to get in. And then like I said, looking at the illustrators, I'm like, oh, I can tell these illustrators are good at, not, some are good at, like one was good at gag, because one of them's kind of like a gag punchline, but like the rest are just visually good with like character faces. So that can really sell it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's having that openness of genre, because you know, I didn't know what I was going to get. You know, I tried giving as much of a good balance. Like there's a sports one in there. There's an actual medical drama one, which I thought was super interesting. Raymond is doing, she's the writer, and she's working with, I feel bad, I always mess people's names up. Shadia Emin, who's done work for Marvel. She's on Spider-Ham. So they're working on, and Kyla Aiko's doing letters, and I've collaborated with Kyla on Crackle 3, and they're an amazing letterer and illustrator in their own right. But they're doing a medical drama, thinking more grounded, like what does a frontline person working in emergency rooms, like what is the purpleized condition? Like how does it affect their day to day? Cause there were a lot of medical pitches, but they were like trying to solve like a logical puzzle. Like how am I going to, this person cures the purple eyes. And I didn't like that direction because it wasn't grounded in people. Like I said, it was more like someone trying to prove a logical conundrum. And so between Raymond,
well, you also don't want somebody curing it in your first volume, right? You don't want somebody like fix it, especially if you've got volumes planned down the road. But let me ask you about the Purple Eyes thing in general, because I mean, it sounds like you said, this anthology occurs 10 years, or the stories in it occur somewhere around like 10 years since it first appeared, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, it sounds like a lot of this has, there's like, you know, it's relating to a little bit of our current world where we've sort of dealt with like a really, you know, strange and weird pandemic that we never thought we were going to, you know, live through. And now we're sort of at the point where we're trying to, or at least certain parts of society are trying to say like, hey, let's pull out. We're going to live with it. It's going to be here for a long time. So it seems like you found something that is very sort of like relatable to our current world and sort of speaking to like what we're trying to crawl out of a bit, right?
A tad. I mean, that was definitely not in the forefront of my mind.
Sure.
When doing all this, like, even though I wrote the initial script and came with the premise of Purple Eyes, during the pandemic, during the height of the pandemic.
I think it snuck in there a little bit, Philip.
Yeah. There's, like, I love Kurt Vonnegut, and there's PBS did a web series called Blank on Blank. I think I've chatted about this before on here, and it's a fantastic podcast, or like a little, they do animations. They had someone animate, I should go back. So Blank on Blank, they have like famous authors and innovators. They take, like a public domain interview that they did or a public speaking event that that this person did. And they edit it up to like some chunks, and they have like an animator animate some of the parts.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out.
And it's really interesting. Because it's, you know, PBS, and they source everything, like the source to the original interview that they end up editing is, you know, is linked in like in the description. And so Vonnegut was really good. His was, I'd like to say he was interviewed at a college. It wasn't one of his commencement speeches, but he's like, don't, like, as the writer, don't write about yourself, or like, don't put yourself like in the story, like as far as like your personal experiences and stuff. It's like you will be writing about yourself regardless, whether you realize it or not. So it's like, you can't really escape it. And then the more you try to escape it, it's either going to be garbage writing, or it's going to end up just being, you know, a pie in your face, and you're going to be writing about yourself regardless.
Well, it sneaks in there, right? I think if you're sort of you can look at yourself as an artist, like anything is going to sneak in at some point, right?
Yeah. I mean, cause it's just an extension of your own personal experiences and thoughts. Like, you know, for me, writing is, you know, this outward manifestation of the inward, but it's also this urge that needs to be quelled. I don't know how else to put it. Like, it's
sure. Have like, you seen that Vonnegut documentary? I think it's either on Hulu or HBO Max, like came out, I think, last year. It's
no.
Really good. It's this filmmaker who was trying to make a documentary, and in the course of time, he basically became friends with him, and they became like family, and he's awesome. Just talks about, you should check it out. If I can find the link, I'll send it to you after we chat. But I watched it a couple of months ago maybe, and I thought it was great. So if you're a Vonnegut fan, you should definitely check that out. But as far as like Purple Eyes, Vonnegut doesn't need any more people talking about him. Plenty of people know about Vonnegut. Purple Eyes, is it sort of like, so you had said like maybe 10 years ago, like is it like by dying by anything, or you're dying by purple eyes? Like if I have cancer and I have 73 minutes to live, do I get the purple eyes? Or if I'm going to be shot and I'm going to, or is it a thing of like, this is a condition, a disease or something, and if you have it and don't know it, then you're going to die in 73 minutes. Am I making sense?
Yeah, it's more the former than the latter. So
okay, so it could be anything.
Yeah, and how I describe it is, it's just like a almost like a physiological warning, and like so whatever your religious belief systems are, it's, you know, people think it's a reaffirmation of like fate, like everything is predetermined. You know, I tried like really thinking about this, like some people would think it's almost a representation of the collective unconscious, like our subconsciouses are all linked and we're all sending each other information at any given time. And this is just an extension of that where we're giving each other all this information. We're all mentally linked in some type of form and capacity all across the world. And this is just us giving each other, like I said, information and another layer, you know, an extension of that, like a our body's changing to give out a warning. But then I tried countering that, saying that, you know, just like say, like if there's, I don't know, it's, like I said, if there's like a tornado coming, that's something that's beyond the scope of human capacity to predict.
Yeah.
It's such a thing, like, yes, there might be a tornado coming and it will end, you know, and it will be devastating. But the precision of that 73 minutes, or the rough estimate that equals 73 minutes, that's beyond the scope, you know, because you can't just, you know, humans are pretty intelligent, but they can't just look at a tornado coming and be like, yeah, it's going to hit my feet about this time.
Not unless you're Jean de Bont in Twister or something like that. No, but I mean, so this is interesting to me. Does it happen to everyone who dies? Is it selective? So like if you were like, so like, let's say this is the idea that's popping into my head, right? Like you had an hour and a half and you were on a SWAT team and you had to disarm a nuclear weapon and you were like, or okay, at least I know like in the next hour and a half or whatever, in the next hour, not an hour and a half, cause that's too much time, but I know my math, 73 minutes. But like if I was a SWAT team and I had an hour to disarm a nuclear weapon and like go in and shoot a terrorist and stuff like that, and I would know that in that 73 minutes, that hour that I have to get in there and disarm this whatever bomb or whatever, I would know that I'm not going to die. Like, does it happen to everyone or is it just randomly like selective?
Yeah, it happens to everyone. It's not a random.
So that would be a way of being able to like, like if I was going to do something crazy, you know, like jump off a bridge or like skydive or something like that, I would know that I'm not going to die. So in a way, it's also kind of like a safety marker, right?
Ah, see, that's the caveat. Yeah, I've thought about that as well. So yes, there's like part of the pitch, I should kind of circle that, but yeah, but like part of when I was opening the pitch submissions, I had like a kind of like brainstorming, jumping off bullet points of how the, like how I saw people would interact in this world. And I said, there'd be, you know, for the daredevils out there, it's just even more heightened. You know, if you go, you know, if you go snowboarding, you know, you jump out of the helicopter and go snowboarding off a huge, you know, down a huge mountainside, or you're in one of those squirrel flying suits and jump off the mountain.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, well, I'm cool. I'm, you know, this is obviously not going to take an hour and some change to complete, and my eyes are okay. But you go through with that and something happens, like you maim yourself. You're in a coma, like you survive, but you are definitely,
you can get hurt
for the rest of your life. Yeah.
Yeah. You can still get hurt, but at least you're not dead. So No, that's interesting. I mean, that to me is almost, it's kind of like a safety marker. So yeah, to your point, I think it might make people more reckless in a way without thinking things through.
Yeah, because the repercussions, yeah, you might, it's a mental safety net.
Yeah.
Like, so you might be more careless because you're like, yeah, like anything. So it kind of what you were saying about the SWAT one, we were kind of playing around with, you know, ways that, to, like I said, to fill the world. We're like thinking of almost like a movie poster, you know, almost like a John Wick type of movie poster, like the hero with, you know, with 40 guns in front of their face and all the gun, you know, the people with the guns have purple eyes and the hero doesn't have purple eyes. Like, it's like, just like things, like ways people would, I guess.
So that's interesting because then the people like pointing the henchmen or whatever, they would get purple eyes, and then they would be like, well, maybe I shouldn't step into this situation where I'm going to go. Like, it creates like all kinds of like interesting ideas of how people might act. Could you stop the purple eyes, or is it just like definite no matter what?
It's definitive and definite. And like, wow. I said, that's part of the, you know, that's part of the fun of it is, yeah, it's there's ways that people can try to break it. Like, I guess in that sense, like that one of the henchmen's like, yeah, I ain't doing this.
Yeah, no, like, thanks.
Leaves, and then, you know, the main character has a side partner that, you know, kills the person anyhow, type
sure.
of thing.
Like, or he just trips on, you know, a soap in the bathtub or something. Like,
yeah,
that's crazy. So that's interesting, because you would almost have a way to sort of determine your own death if you were that sort of character, right? So you were like, either I go out in a blaze of glory, you know, or idiocy, or, you know, I'm just going to, you know, fall asleep in my bathtub, or something falls on me at home, or like that. That's kind of really kind of crazy in a way.
Yeah. And the thing that neither of us has mentioned is that in all these scenarios, you know, you've been aware since the point of eye transition. So there's, you know, this could happen and you're not looking at the mirror. You're not, you might be by yourself and you don't know how much time has passed. Like, you might be aware of it. And
oh yeah.
So it's just
like
getting
pink eye or something. You're like, how long? Yeah. Yeah.
So that's so many different, like, you, like I said, you can play the logical puzzle game and counter some type of stuff, but like in the day-to-day real world, like living amongst this world, there's just so many different types of contingencies. And yeah, and that was one of the good things about all these pitches, is like everyone that's in this book came at it from different angles. Like,
yeah,
there's like spiritual ones. Okay. Valeria, she's in Chile. She's doing a stream of consciousness story of almost when you have purple eyes and you die, there's like a visual kaleidoscope of images that she's working on that, you know, it keeps ambiguous of whether it's passing on to whatever your personal spiritual afterlife is, and or reincarnation cycle. And so like there's aspects of that, like not supernatural, but like spiritual ones and visual ones, because this is comic books and you can do anything because it's words and pictures.
Yeah.
Like there's action ones, like I said, there's comedy ones, medical dramas. Yeah, a few, there's one really good revenge, like pure revenge story. And just how people just thought, you know, so the best ones were ones that almost had the purple eyes as a secondary type of aspect of the book. So it was, mm-hmm. the impetus was the purple eyes that made them have the decision. But the fact that the characters made the decision while we're watching it, you know, watching them either seek revenge or just do something kind of silly with their last moments of life, that's the ones that got into the book, because it was basically, you know, it was the fundamentals were the characters and what the characters did or said, whether, like I said, whether they'd be selfish or whether they just be kind of comical. That's what's going to stick in the reader's mind more than the person gets purple eyes reveal, like the person getting the purple eyes is the big astonishment part. It's like, no, what's really going to stick is the story and obviously the art are going to stick in people's minds a month from down the line. So I mean, that, like I said, that's what we're curating as far as linking all the stories together, like making sure, you know, there are pieces in a puzzle, like, yeah. They're, you know, each individual piece is, you know, each individual piece is unique And it's going to be special. It's going to have, like I said, stories of beginning and middle and end, and feel like a complete story, and you can read it standalone.
Oh, okay. So there's no like breakup things or like cliffhangers or, you know.
Oh, God, no. No. Because I just think it's kind of cheap. I mean, especially with an anthology.
Yeah.
You can have like punchlines, I guess, at the end, but there's not going to be any stories. Like, I got that as pitches of like the person gets purple eyes, and that's kind of like the punchline. And then I was like, but then what next? Like, that's for me, that's not enough. Like, that, you know, you're building it to get this punchline of the person gets purple eyes, but you're reading an anthology knowing full well the rules of the world. And so the reader is going to just know that's coming. And if that's your big reveal, then that is hollow. Like, and you need to have the characters and characters do something. That's, like I said, that's what people are going to remember. So, I mean, yeah, even though, like I said, the purple eyes prompt is, you know, that's the big catch-all thing. But like I said, the reader's going to know. And so like the best stories are going to have that, like, kind of twists and playing on the rules type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's one that didn't get in the anthology that I loved. I just couldn't find room for it. But like, budget wise, tell you the truth, if I had a, you know, if the budget was pretty high, the budget's pretty high right now, because I'm wanting to pay a good pay rate. All the money's going to the creators, or a good chunk of the money's going to the creators, and the rest is going to the printing of the book. But like, one of the really cool ideas was like, all right, well, you see someone gets purple eyes right away, and the town, it's like a small town. The town doesn't want to put up with this person's BS, and just like, all right, well, this person's cursed, or not cursed, but like, this person has purple eyes. You know, whatever's going to befall this person, we want to get away from them. So they bring the person out of town. You know, it's not that far, so they drive the person out of town. And, you know, the rest of the town's like, oh, yeah, we got rid of that, you know, that person, because that person's just going to mess everything up. But then, what is it? Yeah, but then everyone else in the town gets purple eyes. So I figure what happened. So the original person that's out there ends up dying. I forget what was the cause. But the point is, everyone else in the town gets purple eyes too, because whatever the impetus of bringing that person outside of the town,
outside,
like, starts a gas leak, and then the town, I can't remember. It's either a gas leak or a sinkhole, like, kills everyone else.
Interesting. Nice, nice.
But it's just like one of those things, like, all right, well, you use the person set up in motion what the first domino that led to everyone else's fates.
Yeah,
you know, type of those things.
Is that called dramatic irony? I think I may be right. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
that's a good. That's a nice little story. But that's not in this anthology, right?
It's it didn't. There was a couple ones that were like similar, like that, where there was one
Twilight
individual.
Zone-y.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's basically, they're kind of Twilight Zones. I haven't mentioned this at all in any of the podcasts, because I always try to give you the exclusives, Christian.
Oh, yay!
But one of the things that kind of was in the forefront when I was looking at these pitches is, back, you know, I'm back in my old days, when, because I'm an old man, in college I read Machine of Death, and that was a short story collection. Uh-huh. And actually, like, Ryan, if everything's going in full circle here, Ryan North edited that collection, because it was based off of his, at the time he was doing the dinosaur comics, and that was his initial one. And Ryan North just did Slaughterhouse 5 graphic novel.
Oh,
so
wow.
So he's going back full circle. So he's a really big name. He's a really big name, and he did it, and it had almost a similar premise, because it was based off of one of his dinosaur strips. And the idea is that it'd be like almost like Zoltan from from, you know, Tom Hanks is big. So it's like you go to machine and it tells you the method of you dying. And
oh.
I think it's what it is. It's just like the method of you dying.
Okay.
And like I said, this was prose. This was in comics.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. I think there's at least two volumes. I only read the first volume. And like it's supposed to have that kind of like Twilight Zone thing of like you go there and you're a parent and you bring your kid to this thing, you know, just like any old machine. It's supposed to be like pretty ubiquitous type of thing where there's just like all these machines that are 100% accurate of how you're supposed to die. You know, you go there and you're like, you're all excited. You bring your kid there.
You're excited. That sounds horrible.
I know. So, and like you go there and it says like your kid has old age and you're like, oh, thank God. Like, you know, my kid's going to be fine and stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 2 weeks down the line, they get run over by a car, by like Jesus an elderly Christ. Person driving a car that shouldn't have a license.
Oh my God.
So like it's supposed to be like that gallows, like that type of perspective.
Sort
of
monkey's paw, like unexpected.
Yeah.
So
I just remember reading all those short stories, and it had that different multi-genre, multi-perspective type of thing. And yeah, I was like, I kind of want this as me being the editor. I kind of want to have this type of feeling of multiple perspectives on this, you know, basically a writer's prompt, just to fill it out. Because if it is just too much of, you know, if it's too much of the same thing, if a reader sees that two stories are very similar, they might not be invested in that second story, regardless of the storytelling and artistic abilities with those creators. So I wanted variety. I mean, I wish I had more, but we have one like sports one, which was
cool.
It was super interesting. There was a few sports ones, but there was the one that, you know, that we have is a boxer, and there were a few boxer ones, but this one got in because it was a perspective of the opponent. So it's not, you know, there was some that of a boxer getting purple eyes and like going through their final, you know, bout.
Sure.
But this was someone who their opponent got purple eyes and now they're, you know, and you see the fight, but then it's the after that of like the repercussions, the mental like repercussions, who's the main character of like, you know, I know this person willingly did this and we were in the ring, but like I killed this person. Like basically I killed this person. And like, it's one of those things like, but this is like, this person chose to do this. I chose to do this as well. We were, you know, the people around us, no one stopped. Like, it's like all this, you know, just like the thinking of that is just bonkers.
Well, and I know that sort of takes me to a place of like, am I even going to be the one that is responsible, like just because of the random, like, you know what I mean? Maybe it's not even the boxing fight. Maybe he, you know, I don't, you know, that it's interesting. That's a very interesting take. And that's in this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, sounds like a great idea. Let me ask you this. Well, a couple of questions. When you get the purple eyes, does it happen like immediately, like your eyes just turn purple, or does it sort of fade in? Like, are people going like, do I have purple in my eye? Is it purple there? Is it like, is there a sort of like a paranoia that develops among the populace or?
Yeah. I mean, we haven't really talked about it, but I want it to be as instantaneous as possible.
Sure.
But yeah.
I just imagine like a nebbishy Woody Allen like character walking around and being like, do I have purple? Is it purple? Like, is this happening? Am I going? And then the other question to you is, I mean, obviously I have a comic that's, you know, purple, has sort of purple in it, but why purple? Why the color purple?
I mean, there is no really nice like answer. I mean, other than the fact that I thought about that being just a unique color in general. I mean, I've tried to like, maybe like work my mental way backwards, but it was just kind of like, use purple, because then I started like researching you know, purple's not a natural eye color.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then one of the things I was kind of thinking, like when I was looking more, I'm like, all right, so one of like the, I guess like fun facts almost of, you know, like why was Watchmen so successful? There's so many breakdowns of what Watchmen was as far as a dissection of what comic books were and stuff.
Yeah.
And it, like, the idea is that part of it was, look, if you flip through Watchmen, it uses the inverse colors of what is normally used. So, like, in most comics use, you know, RGB. They use red, green, and blue. And Watchmen uses a lot of pinks, yellows, and purples. Like, if you flip through it, it is full of those colors.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of like my thinking too of like, all right, well, what's something that's kind of unique? And like this, the more I keep like thinking about it, like the more I can keep like hammering down, like why this is a good idea. Like, I just like think that like so someone smarter than me can figure out that, you know, purple slash violet is on the opposite, is on one end of the visual spectrum. So like, yeah, you have Roy G. Biv, and that's the limit. So I wonder if that has some type of connotation. Like, I know it's the little that I know of that stuff that has the lowest wavelengths. Red has the highest wavelengths and violet has the lowest wavelength. So maybe there's something to that as far as data transmission. You know, it's the least amount of data being transferred, I guess. You know, because red has the most information, so that's why it's harder to capture on film and you know, pictures, and violet has the least amount of information. I think that's how that works. But yeah, so this is like all these, like, you know, it's just coming at this idea from at all angles type of thing. But yeah, sure. It's just straight up like, yeah, let's just do purple.
That's great. So when is the next volume? How does this sort of delay Crackle, or does it?
Yeah, it does delay Crackle. You know, I'm putting my editor hat on. I am not writing short stories. I haven't written a short story. Like, I always have a notebook full of ideas, and then I just kind of like, you know, like I look like Charlie Day in the mailroom. Like, I'm just circling things and pointing, trying to figure out ways to combine ideas.
Yeah.
But yeah, it puts a little delay on the Crackles. You know, I'm still trying to figure out what's the next project. Like, as much as, you know, I do want to do volume two of this pretty much right away, I do know that I would like to do like more writing, obviously. Like, I want, like, sure. I need to get that itch out. So I'm trying to play around with, do I want to continue and do a Crackle 4, which I know is somewhat of a safe play because I have, you know, it's volume 4 of self-contained short stories. So people can pick up the previous Crackles and, or this standalone Crackle, and be, you know, be sufficient, or do I want to, you know, finally, you know, go deeper into the waters and go and do a longer form, you know, I always call them like, not like a bande dessinée, but like something almost like last time we chatted, like I want to kind of do like a novella, almost what, you know, Brubaker and Phillips are doing with Reckless. Like,
yeah.
I kind of like that type of girth of like 75, 80 pages or so, work on it for 6 to 8 months, you know, in theory.
Yeah.
Have this succinct. I know, I mean, Reckless's are linking stories and stuff, but to have like a succinct, bulkier than a one shot, something with a spine, but still not enough pages where I can be like, all right, well, I project this to be, let's just say, like, I don't know, like if I'm already doing 75, 80, like, all right, if this is going to be like a 90, if I think, you know, if it's a 90 page thing, that I'm not going to be splitting up into 3:30-ish page increments or chunks, it's going to be like, all right, no, I'm going to do this one solid thing, the artists and I, and this will be the book straight from the beginning. I'm not going to try to figure out where to force these mini cliffhanger breaks within the story that may feel unnatural, or chapter breaks or something like that. So that's the idea. Like I said, I have a separate notebook of an idea of that I like of someone traversing an island, and there's a couple strange things on the island, shadow monsters and stuff. And there's connecting stepping stones leading to other islands with other things, but it's just like, and other mazes, underground mazes and things. But like, yeah, it's like I have all these ideas, but it's like sitting down and figuring out.
Well, right now you have your editor's hat on, right? Pretty much trying to get.
I do that. I'll give you another exclusive. Like, I really want to do the story, and I want to do something that I've only really seen in like gag comics, like almost like gag strips. But I want to have like a silent protagonist who cannot, like, their word bubbles, are blank, but they have the ability to take the word bubbles and shape them. So almost like an actual balloon, like making
balloon animals or something, or like,
yeah, but like they can take that balloon and like almost change it into like morph it into like almost like a bow and arrow, or like the person can morph it into a rope, like things that they can use to interact in the world. So like to have like almost a silent, like an example of the silent protagonist. Like, I just never have seen a story that does something like that. Like, I've seen it, you know, I've seen, I think there's like a famous one with like a pig where like the pig's like, I need a dollar. And then like kind of like steals the dollar from themselves by the end of the book, like a reoccurring fourth wall break. But like, I've never seen that type of fourth wall break. It's not even a fourth wall break, 'cause it's not like interacting with the audience per se. It's interacting with the elements that the audience knows, like the language of comics, but playing around with, yeah, it's just like this, like, I really like that idea. And then obviously shadow monsters and
that mystery sounds stuff. Challenging.
Yeah.
That sounds challenging.
That's why I haven't stepped up to the plate yet.
Well, like, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time. But for now, you've got Purple Eyes, right? And that's on Kickstarter. And I mean, all these ideas sound really interesting. I mean, obviously, you're always welcome on the podcast. Episode 400, Philip. What 400. Do you think? 400. Woo! We did it. 400 episodes of Part-Time Fanboy. But for right now, Purple Eyes, where can people find you again on like the Twitters? Twitter is your main thing, right?
Yeah, that's where I hang out the most. Yeah. So on all the social medias.
Even with Elon buying the whole thing, are you sticking in there? Everyone's freaking out. I don't think he's going to buy it, but.
It's just a new landlord. It's the same.
I don't know about that, dude, but okay.
All the tenants are still crazy and the apartment. So this is a new landlord who doesn't.
Well, he's just going to bring in crazier tenants. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's also probably true.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm Philip Myra. So PhilipMyra. And that's, like I said, on Twitter. I'm on Instagram too. That's more of a visual base. So you can see, you know, whenever I have new whips from the artist, you know, the works in progress or sketches, you know, that's more visual based. So that's where they go. But yeah, like Kickstarter, go to Kickstarter and type in Purple Eyes. I'm there, or I have purpleeyescomic.com will bring you there.
Oh, nice.
I also figured out, I just typed in the word die, D-I-E, into Kickstarter, like their algorithm.
Yeah.
And so I popped up, and then, you know, Karen Gillian's, you know, he's doing the die the board game version of the of Die, like his comic.
Oh, wow.
So I just thought it was, they're doing gangbusters. At the time of recording this, they've been live, I think, for 3 days or 4 days. And they're over, I thought they were like over the 100 grand mark. Yeah, I could be wrong.
Games do great on Kickstarter. But, yeah. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Philip Myra. We're talking about Purple Eyes. We're talking about Part-Time Fanboy. We're talking about Christian Horn. We're talking about episode 400. That's all we're talking about. We're not helping other people. We're helping you, sir. So everyone go to Purple Eyes on Kickstarter. Check out Philip Myra's stuff. Check out all the creators. I checked out the Kickstarter. Obviously, I've looked at it. I still have to throw my money at it, which I probably do right now. I got like so many Kickstarters getting thrown, so many crowdfunding, but I'm going to throw money at this because I really, really do enjoy your work. I do appreciate you coming on to my show. I appreciate you reaching out to me every time. Every time you reach out to me, you're like, hey, Christian, I don't know if I'm bothering you, but can I come back? And I'm like, dude, anyone who wants to come and chat with me about comics or whatever they're doing, you are more than welcome. Just reminding everyone that it is Part-Time Fanboy, though. So I'm actually getting a lot of requests lately, and I'm trying to be like, okay, things are piling up. Just I will get to you. Just keep reminding me. Don't hound me. Just keep reminding me. But Philip, you're always welcome. The Kickstarter project is Purple Eyes. I will just say that I'm going to be at Collector's Paradise this weekend with my comic, Periwinkle Puss, and prints and postcards and all my fun art stuff. And yeah, that's it. Episode 400 of Part-Time Fanboy. My name's Christian Horn. I can't believe I did it. I can't believe I've done it for 10 years, but all right, ready to go. Another 400 coming down the pike. Maybe. I don't know if I'll last that long. Anyway, you could check us out on parttimefanboy.com, on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, the thing that Elon Musk may or may not own by the time this airs. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening as always. Obviously, this podcast would not be here without the wonderful guests, without the wonderful listeners, without the wonderful supporters, without my wife and family to help me keep me going. But yeah, 400 episodes in the can. Done. Bam. We are ready to go. Next up, episode 500. Here we go. Thank you, Philip, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Fanboy.com.